listening to this week's LaFever CFC podcast. Connect with us via our website, lafevercfc.com, or our Facebook page, www.facebook.com/LaFever CFC. We hope you enjoy this week's message.
For me, God's presence is something which I've known deeply, at times fleetingly, at just the right time, and sometimes not when I wish I had felt it. I don't know if that's the same for you. Sometimes God's presence isn't something that you feel when you wish that you were. And it's not entirely clear why, but I'm pretty certain it's me rather than God. I don't think his presence has moved at all. And yet, in me, there's stuff that's getting in the way of knowing who he is in my life. Yeah? So I don't know if it's the same for you, but sometimes we just have to be still and get out of the way, pretty much. Yeah, if we could get that one back on there again, Danny. Not that one. It was good, Bill, but let's... my turn now. All right, so the things we're talking about are sort of parables, sayings, events that happened that have been recorded from Jesus' life that aren't quite so clear. And this is one that I started thinking about a little while ago, and it's just been going ruminating in my mind and in my heart, I guess. And so I thought I'll talk about it. I've titled this Mountains and Figs When a Holy Curse is Actually a Blessing. Okay. I appear to have a clicker problem, Danny, so could you forward that on for me? Hey, nice one. All right, so I'm going to stand over here so that I can read this. This is the verses that I'm going to be preaching from. It's in Mark 11, it's also in Matthew 21, just similar. Now the next day, when they'd come out from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing from afar a fig tree having leaves, he went to see if perhaps he would find something on it. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. In response, Jesus said to it, "Let no one eat fruit from you ever again." Skipping forward a few verses. Now in the morning, as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots. And Peter, remembering, said to him, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree which you cursed has withered away." So Jesus answered and said to them, "Have faith in God. For assuredly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, 'Be removed and be cast into the sea,' and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that those things he says will be done, he will have whatever he says. Therefore I say to you, whatever things you ask when you pray, believe that you will receive them, and you will have them." So the question is, what was Jesus on about? Now, some things that go through my mind are, where were they when all of this happened? What was the context? What does the fig represent? And what about the mountain? Now, I reckon you would have heard people preach on these topics before. You might have read it and come up with your own ideas. And what I'm going to share today is a way of reading the Bible which is far from literal. Okay, I'm going to put that right out there. This is an allegorical way of reading the Bible, which if you read most of the quotes of Paul in the New Testament, he reads the Old Testament as an allegory. What that means is he's saying there is a truth in the scripture, which is what the word says, which is true, and then there's another truth even deeper below that truth. And that's the truth that actually God is pointing toward. So I'm going to try and do that here, but what I say may not be right, okay? Because I'm a human, but I'm going to have a crack at it. Because what I've heard a lot of this preached about before is that The reason that the fig tree was cursed was that the fig tree represents Israel. If you do a quick search on the internet, this is mostly what you'll find. The fig tree represents Israel, and Jesus was cursing it, i.e. Israel, because it was religiously barren. Then the mountain being moved and getting everything you asked for has been great defence for the prosperity gospel. For those of you perhaps newer to faith, you might not be aware of the prosperity gospel. I hope you're not. My apologies if you are. The prosperity gospel pretty much says you deserve to be wealthy and rich because you belong to God, and verses like this support that idea. Problem is, reality is clearly that's not true. Not everybody can be dirty rich, right? And that isn't, I believe, what God is ultimately promising us. The other one, which I reckon is probably one of the most dangerous, is, and for me, this is how I've read often when I was younger. It said something like there, you know, like if you said to the mountain to move into the sea and you did not have doubt in your heart, then it would happen. And so then I would go, well, I prayed for someone or something and it didn't happen. Ah, must have been me. There was a bit of doubt in me, and that's what caused the problem. I'm going to have to try harder next time. Right? So I reckon that's how most of us would read that part. That's like the take home. I'm going to argue that none of that is the way that Jesus wanted it to be understood. So let's have a look at the context first. So first thing is, so this is in Mark 11 and Matthew 21. The stories are a little bit different from one another, but the crux of it is the same, but just the way that the order of things is slightly different. I'm going to go with the Mark 11 account because I think it's a little bit more detailed. And it says, basically, so if you recall Palm Sunday, so a bit before Easter, we celebrate Palm Sunday, which is when Jesus triumphantly enters Jerusalem. You guys are aware of that story, right? What does he ride in on? A donkey. Nice one. So in he goes. They're the gates, by the way, that he probably went through. I did notice, though, the lighting has been upgraded in the last couple of thousand years. So maybe they had candles or something back then, some torches, but that's the gates, as best I can understand, that would have been gone through. From what I can tell, you don't actually go through that front bit, which looks like solid brick. So go around a little bit and then you go in, which would have been a better way to defend the gates from marauders, right? Okay, in he went. Later on, at the end of the day, so they went in, had a party, lots of adulation, lots of great stuff, and then Jesus and the 12 disciples actually left Jerusalem to stay the night at Bethany, which was a nearby town. Okay, now, it's not called Bethany anymore. It's called El Helin. I can't really say it quite clearly. It actually means place of Lazarus, which is interesting because it's not far away from Lazarus's tomb. Interesting stuff. So this photo using Google Maps is if you are standing on top of the Golden Gate, the entryway into Jerusalem, and then looking mostly east, then off there in the distance is Bethany, and then further back is the Dead Sea, and in between you and there is the Mount of Olives. Okay, you would have heard the Mount of Olives before. At the base of the Mount of Olives, just closer to us, you can actually see it says Gethsemane. Why is Gethsemane a famous word? Anyone remember? Yep, so Jesus went there and prayed before the soldiers came and arrested him, and then away he went from there toward the whole passion story. Okay, so that's just to give you a bit of perspective. So what we're going to be talking about is what happened on the road between the Golden Gate and Bethany. Now, I don't actually know where the road went, but I'm going to show you in a minute that hill is more like a ridge and it's actually relatively steep. So they probably went around the edge, which is where the actual highway goes now. Just for people who are interested, that's the West Bank up there. So that's sort of more Palestinian territory, but under Israeli control now. Okay. So it was on the way back then from Bethany the next morning, coming back to Jerusalem, that Jesus cursed the fig tree. That's a Moreton Bay fig. Wouldn't have been one of them. But if you've been up on the hill at the cricket, then that's what you sit under, right? Beautiful tree, but it probably looked more like this. That's a fig tree. They can look pretty amazing, but if you're out in a more arid environment without irrigation, that's probably what a fig tree would have looked like. Then they went in to the temple and cleansed it of money changers. That's when Jesus drove everyone out. And if you recall, I preached on that a couple of months ago, talking about the fact that Jesus was not, we don't read that story as Jesus being angry at us for the things we do wrong, but that at the lies that get in the way of us being the place of worship that God seeks. He wasn't angry at people so much as at the lack of worship that was able to happen in the temple because of the things that were being done. And he wants us to be in worship with him, in relationship with him. Okay, so that happened. Then, on the way back to Jerusalem, then they go to Bethany. The next morning, coming back to Jerusalem, they notice the fig tree is dead. Then he says you could have faith to move a mountain, and it would be lovely if it was that mountain. That's what I imagine, but it wasn't. Most likely it was this mountain, which is more like, you know, the Adelaide version of a mountain. I sometimes have international visitors come, and as I'm driving along out to Roseworthy, I point up to the Mount Lofty Ranges and I say, and there are our mountains. And they go, where? I go, you know, those things just up there. And they go, oh, they're mountains, are they? Because if you're from Europe, you're used to the mountains I showed you on the other page. The Jewish people, perhaps a little bit more similar to us, they're used to these arid, well-worn environments. And so this ridge was probably the mountain that they would have been standing around. And I'm imagining Jesus and the disciples were on their way between Jerusalem and Bethany, back and forth. It's about 3 km roughly. And this mountain was in the way. So it would make sense that they were probably talking about that mountain. Don't know for certain. Mount of Olives. Okay. So that's the context. All right. But now I want to go right back to the fig. This is a fig leaf. Tell me something about fig leaves. Can anyone tell me where's this come from, fellas? Where's this scripture from? What book in the Bible?
Genesis.
Nice one. Bonus points if anyone knows the chapter. Ooh. So for people who are on Zoom, it says, they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings. Okay, so Genesis 3, it's after the whole creation account, and then we have the fall. And then after the fall, so this is where basically Adam and Eve go and do the one thing that God said, don't do that over there. Just don't do that. Don't eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. That's not a good idea. And they were tempted, and they decided to go and do it because in doing that, they felt that they would become like God. Okay. But when they did become like God. They started to know the difference between right and wrong. And when that happened, they felt something. What did they feel? Why did they have to cover themselves? Shame. Okay. They felt shame. And so they covered themselves. Was it good that they covered themselves? Let me rephrase it. Is it good that we are all wearing clothes right now? Okay. So if it's good for us, it was good for Adam and Eve. Yeah, I mean, they're married, they're together. I guess you could have got away with it. But once their kids grew up a bit, it would have just got embarrassing. It's like, oh, mum, put some clothes on, you know, like that. If my mum was here, I'd pay her out right now, but she's not, so we won't. Right, so it was good that the fig leaves went on. In fact, God made it even better. What did God do? Do you know? He sewed together garments, yeah, out of animal hides. Is what it says. I just want to come back to the fig leaf though. So the fig leaf served a purpose. It helped to cover the shame that Adam and Eve were experiencing, right? So what I want to try and do here is equate the fig tree with the law and the sacrifices. But I want to go a layer deeper than that and say the fig leaf represents everything that you and I do in order to make ourselves good with God and good with each other. Everything we do in our own power to try and undo the shame. The fig, I'm going to argue, represents all of the things that we do for good purposes to undo the bad things that are in life. And that some of these things are even given to us by God, such as clothes, or the law, or sacrifice. So if we go back into the Old Testament, God gave them the law, to help them see right from wrong, to be able to make a way in the wilderness amongst all of these groups who didn't know who God was, and to be able to stay in good relationship with God. He gave them the law and sacrifice so that they could worship him and participate in goodness and holiness with God. Yeah? So we're going to argue that the fig represents that. So, the fig leaf is good. And in fact, it continued to be for quite some time. There's verses through the Bible, like this one, that say, "And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, each man under his vine and under his fig tree, from Dan as far as Beersheba, all the days of Solomon." So the fig tree represents, at that time, prosperity, doing well, okay? Being able to make things work, having a good life. But then Jesus comes along in this story and he curses the fig tree because it's barren. But what's the most unfair thing about this scripture? Doesn't actually say... Yes, it does. What's the most unfair thing about that up there? Wasn't the season for figs. And when we get to this point, we go, "Oh, come off it." Like, fair's fair, or fair crack of the whip, mate. Like, that doesn't seem reasonable to curse a fig tree that clearly shouldn't have been bearing fruit at that point in time. So this is why I don't think it's Israel. Because why would Israel not be bearing fruit? Why shouldn't it be? Should have always been. Right. So I'm going to argue that's why it's not Israel. And the reason I'm saying it's the law, or all of the things we do as humans to make ourselves right with each other and right with God, is because it was good for a time. And this is Jesus actually saying something really clearly. He's saying, it is no longer the time of the fig tree in your life. It is no longer the time for law, for sacrifice, for you, the human, to try and make yourselves good with God and good with each other. It's not that time anymore. It's clearly not that time for this fruit to bear anymore. It's borne for many years, it's sustained you in many ways, and it served its time, and now I curse it because it is the end of it. No more of that. No more of you trying to do it. No more of the law. I will be the one who fulfills the law, said Jesus. I'll be the one who provides you with comfort and shelter. I'll be the one who makes things right. I will be your covering to hide your shame. In fact, you will know no shame any longer because I will bring you into a holy relationship with me. And there is no need for shame. And what I think is interesting about this is, although this happened back then, I think this is something which he says to us right now and multiple times through our lives. And so I would ask you all, me, what is your fig tree? What is your fig leaf in your life right now? I want to share a story for me of something which I held on to for a long time, which I believe became, I'm going to argue in a way it was good, but it was actually really terrible. I fell into a really bad habit somewhere in my mid-teens, I don't know when it was exactly, of revving myself up to do well at something by threatening myself with death. So I had decided somewhere in my life that doing well would cover up my feelings of loneliness or not being good enough somewhere. I think we all somewhere discover that as a child, where you get a pat on the back for doing something well and you realise, oh, that felt good. If I do more good stuff, people are going to think I'm good, and then I'm good, and then I feel good about myself. So I'm going to keep on trying to do good stuff. And I was able to do this academically, and so sometimes I'd hit a difficult place in my studies or in school or whatever, or I'd be getting tired and I needed to push through. And I would say, I remember it would be like a mantra for me, which would be something along these lines: Hayden, if you can't get this done, your life isn't worth living. That's what I'd say to myself internally, and it would spur me on. Now, don't get me wrong, I had no suicidal ideation. Although if things hadn't have gone well, I don't know. But I absolutely used this loss of my life, or more to the point, I was saying, I'm worthless unless I succeed. And I said that to myself over and over again. And guess what? I succeeded. It was good for a time. What I said was not good, but it led to a good outcome for me in that I succeeded. We play tricks on ourselves over and over where we think that the fig leaf truly covers our shame. But what it never undid for Adam and Eve was the fact that they had chosen a way that God had said, don't go there. So for me, if I look back at that time, and I reckon it was for about 10 years for me until I realised what was going on and had to work through that. For me, what I realised is a couple of elements to that that are really dangerous. The first one is, I'd believe the lie that I had to succeed in order to be lovable. Ultimately, that was the lie deep down inside. You need to do well in order to be accepted and loved. Then on top of that, I went, you're only worth living if you then succeed. In other words, I have to be loved and accepted in order to be living. That's not a healthy place to be. And I'm sure that came out in me in many other ways without me knowing at the time. But I guess what I wanted to say to everyone is, I reckon we all have things that are in your life that have served a purpose. They're a good thing at the time. There are many children who go through horrible, horrible stuff in their life as a child, and they necessarily form a defense mechanism to protect themselves. And that is a really, really good thing that that child learns how to do that at that time. But it's a horrible thing when they become an adult and try and enter into a relationship with a husband or wife or a good friend, or to know the love of the Father God, while hanging on to that protective mechanism that's keeping them from close relationship with anyone. Or maybe things aren't safe, and so we build up in our lives a sense of anxiety. Because anxiety is actually a good thing. If you don't have any anxiety, you will lay on the couch and not even bother to get up and get food. Anxiety is the thing that says, I'm hungry, it's time to go and get food. It's a protective mechanism. Anxiety is good. Anxiety is really not good when it leads to becoming debilitating, because what you've decided deep down inside is the world is not safe and I have to look after myself. I have to be hyper-vigilant, hyper-aware at all times, because there's going to be something out there that's going to hurt me. And I think what God's saying to us is, enough already. Let go of the fig leaf already. Maybe it did something for a while, but what I'm going to deal with is the shame that underlies it. I'm going to deal with the fear. I'm going to deal with the lie. You don't have to hang on to that anymore. So what good thing? I want to pay respect to the fact that these things that we rely on, you may not think of them as being bad, because they have probably served you well. They're not there by accident. What good thing, in quotation marks, do you need to let go of in your life? And I'll argue you have to, because if you don't, how do we grab hold of God? How do we fully rest in God while choosing to do it ourselves? You can't. But letting go of this, pretty scary, because it's something that served you well. But without the death of that thing, there can't be a birth of something new. It's just not possible. I can't know the full love of God for me or my family for me until I've let go of the idea that I have to earn their love through good performance. If I hang on to that idea, it is impossible for me to experience the fullness of God's love for me. They don't go together. Like oil and water, they will not mix. What are we going to let go of? But it's not always so easy. So I think this is where the mountain comes in. What happens if I'm here and I want to go there, but between me here and where I want to go, there is a mountain, an obstacle in the way? And these things that we hang on to feel like they are insurmountable in our life. You can't get over them. How, God, will I climb over this? How will I let go of that thing that I've been hanging on to for my whole life when it's the very thing that keeps me going? So God, Jesus said, have faith in God, for assuredly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that those things he says will be done, he will have whatever he says. I don't believe this is talking about material wealth, or maybe it refers to physical healing. I don't know. But I think that at the end of the day, we all die, don't we? Our physical bodies fade away. That's going to happen. So I think it's talking about something else, mostly. I think it's talking about the stuff in our lives, the things that are in the way of us knowing the goodness of God. Because that's ultimately what we're called to, is a relationship with God. So what could get in the way? Anything that gets in the way of that is like a mountain that needs to be moved, needs to be thrown into the sea. So for me, this fear of being alone or fear of not being wanted, when praying through this with somebody, I realized started when I was about 4 years old for me. So we'd moved into a new house, and I can have this direct recollection of moving into this new house all on my own. I looked up, saw it was a big house in comparison to the little one we were in as a family. I looked up around and no one else was there, and I felt all alone in a big vacant home. I'm four, right? So I can't process things properly at four, but I felt alone. And if I look back at that and I think there was a very small seed of a lie that's implanted in my life at that point in time, and I grabbed hold of that as being somehow true. And there was an element of truth. My folks were busy doing other things, and I was in this big home alone. And so what do I do about that? How do I survive as a small child feeling alone? Well, you start to build up mechanisms around you to protect yourself, right? To not feel alone anymore. And if I look back then on my life, it's like a spider sewing a web through my whole life of loneliness being the thing that I was trying to soothe through my life in so many different ways. And one of them was, as I said before, the need to do well, to have other people like me because I'd done well. So it starts there. So for me, the mountain was this understanding that I'm alone. The difficulty is, it's sort of true. Right? Who has ever felt loneliness in their life? Most of us, right? We feel lonely. Why? Because it's true. Because physically in this world, you are alone at times. You will feel disconnected because we live in a fallen world. But why is it not true? Because what I didn't see as a four-year-old was that as I was standing there as a four-year-old in this big vacant room, Jesus was there with me. I wasn't alone. That was actually a lie. I don't need to succeed to be loved, because Jesus has always loved me and he made me, and it's only his love that matters. You see, unless we can grab a hold of that, then when all of the realities around us, and the reality is you will be abused, you will be alone, things will happen that are bad. So if we're not going to protect against that, then there's a deeper truth we need to hold on to, which is that God loves us and that we are free from that. Believe it or not, this came out for me as a bird phobia, which is a little bit embarrassing when you get to university and you have to do practicals with chickens, and I physically couldn't hold a chicken without vomiting. I'll explain later another time. But anyway, I think I'm pretty much over that. I don't like cuddling chickens. Does anyone? But all right. So I reckon what we're actually being called to here, Jesus goes through the process of the fig tree is not in season. So this time for the fig leaf to be the thing protecting us is over. The fig tree is no longer there to provide us shelter. It's now Jesus' time. So he curses the fig tree. He curses our human designed ways of making life good and curses it and says it will never be productive again. I don't want you to find solace in that. I want you to find solace in me. That's the critical point. So he says that. And then he says, but don't worry. It's going to feel really hard to move on from that, like a mountain in the way. But if you want that mountain to move from here and put it into the sea, we'll do it. That's going to happen because you're with me now, says Jesus. That is not enough to stop you from getting from A to B. We're all going to end up here together at the end of the day. How do we do it? We do it through faith. So why is it that we can't have doubt in our heart? What is doubt in this very moment for me? If I doubt that I am lovable because of God, I immediately believe a lie that I am unlovable. Does that make sense? If I believe any element of the untruth, then I've lost faith in the truth. And if I lose faith in the truth, then how can it save me any longer when I've chosen to be of unbelief and to think that I have to do it myself? Can you see the connection there? It's not a God saying, if you don't believe well enough, I'm not going to help you. It's not that. It's a, these things go hand in hand. How can you have full faith in who I am and what I'm offering and my reality if you choose to believe this lie? That's not belief, that's not faith. And without that, without the faith in the goodness of God, how will you experience it? So I've found this very handy in understanding faith. I believe it is seeing things as God sees them and then behaving consistently with that. I don't believe faith in God means believing there is a God. And it almost does nothing for us. But imagine if you truly believed with every part of your being that the way God sees the world is how it truly is. And you were willing to let go of your view, the veil across your eyes right now, that where you think that the things that are happening around you actually matter. And instead we just held on to the eternal view that God has and we grabbed hold of that at all times. Imagine how transformative that could be for life. All the little things that hold you back, the fear of being rejected, the fear of shame, the fear of loneliness, the fear of not being good enough. These are the things that usually are driving us through a majority of our day, and if you were willing to let go of them, it'd be a scary place to be, but we would enter into an understanding and a relationship with God that I reckon we never have before. And so we constantly move forward toward deeper faith, deeper commitment to seeing the world the way God sees it, which is trusting that that is true. So I might pray, and then maybe we can just take a couple of minutes. Tara, maybe we can just sing something appropriate. But just take a couple of minutes in a minute just to dwell on and ask God, is there anything in my life, Lord, that I am currently relying on to keep me safe, to give me purpose, to drive me forward, that isn't actually you? Am I scared of something? Because I haven't sat in your goodness, been willing to trust you that what you say is true. Is there a conflict in my life that I'm caught up in because I haven't seen the relationship the way you see it, with you in the middle, everything whole, which is the truth, not what I've experienced of truth? Dear Lord, please help us let go of our view of the world and instead hang on to your view of the world. Because we know your view is correct. Your view isn't just right here, right now. Your view is eternal. You see the big picture. We only see our little snapshot from our perspective. Father, give us your eyes for the wholeness of truth. We want to let go of the things which hold us back. Please bring them to our minds. Put someone around us that we can pray with, that we can share with. Lord, nothing is too much for us. And we grab hold of you and your truth and your spirit that lives within us, that is constantly whispering to us and saying, you are mine, you are loved, I created you for a purpose, and that purpose is to be in relationship with me and to discover the fullness of who I am and to experience the world like you've never experienced it before. Lord, we want to let go of the things that hold us back from experiencing that. We don't want the fig anymore. We want your truth. We want to be able to walk around unashamedly, free from everything that ties us back to what is the unreality. The unreality. And instead, we want to step into your reality.